Lauren, it's great to talk to you today. I am Jennifer Acker. I am class of 2000 at of Amherst, and I'm the editor of The Common, which is a new print and online literary magazine that is based at Amherst College and partially supported by Amherst College Press. And we are launching into issue number 4. And you, Lauren, were one of our wonderful authors who contributed to debut issue number 1, which I was really excited about. And so, Lauren, you are class of 2001, just a year after me, and you have an MFA from the University of Madison at Wisconsin, where you worked with Laurie Moore, among other wonderful people. Arcadia is your second novel after your debut of The Monsters of Templeton, and your third book in 4 years, which is pretty incredible, including the short story collection Delicate Edible Birds in 2009, I think. And among many other accolades, Arcadia, which we're going to talk about today, was an editor's choice at the New York Times and was very recently named one of the 10 best books of the year from the Washington Post, alongside Hilary Mantel's Bringing Up the Bodies and Canada by Richard Ford. So I hope you are really excited about that. Congratulations. And I loved Arcadia, so I'm really excited to talk to you about it today. It was incredibly rich and compelling and engrossing and tragic. And it's a pleasure to have this Amherst Reads conversation with you. So, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on. And then I just wanted to say that I am such a huge fan of The Common, and not just because you were so kind to take one of my stories for the first issue, but it's just one of those literary journals that I wait for and devour the day that it comes. So, thank you. I think the love is mutual here.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. So about Arcadia, because this partially comes from The Common being about a sense of place. So where I want to start talking about your lovely novel is that Arcadia, the fictional utopian settlement that's at the heart of your novel, is both a place and an ideal. So I wonder if you could just start by describing Arcadia physically as a place, what it looks like, the buildings and the natural landscape, the people there, how they organize themselves, just a big picture description of Arcadia, which you do so wonderfully in so many places in the book, but just in your own words, how you think of it, what kind of place it is.
Sure. So one of the seeds for the book was that I had read Sir Thomas More's Utopia, which was the place where the word was coined, utopia. And in Greek, it's sort of a portmanteau word. It means both no place and best place. So it's sort of an idealized, imagined place. And it's a very strange book, as a matter of fact, because I think, you know, throughout the years, people saw it as being very straightforward and earnest, as if Sir Thomas More were actually advocating for the world that he created in Utopia, but it's honestly a very satirical work. And one of the frontispieces in the very first edition, I had found it online and I was just amazed by it, is this woodcut of the island of Utopia. And you look at it, it's very beautiful in the way that woodcuts are often very beautiful. But it's also, and after I did some research, I found out it's actually very licentious also. there's a boat sort of sailing into this harbor, and if you look at it the wrong way, it's very phallic, and it's kind of funny in the same way that the book is supposed to be sort of satirical. And so I had this on the wall for a long time, and the central object in this frontispiece, in this woodcut, is this sort of large structure. And it built my particular Arcadia around this idea of the large structure. And so when I did some research, I went to a couple of intentional communities, one of which was Oneida in upstate New York. And Oneida had this, still has this beautiful mansion house, and you can actually stay there as a guest house. It's this huge brick building based on Fourierist utopian ideals, where they used to actually manufacture bear traps and jams and things in there, and everybody lived together, and there's this great big room where they put on plays and musical interludes, and it's just a very beautiful, well-thought-out, well-designed, planned place. And so in my particular Arcadia, I have this old abandoned house that sort of is based on the Oneida Mansion house on top of a hill. And then when my 1960s and 70s radicals get to Arcadia, they didn't even know that there was this abandoned house there. And they built sort of an ersatz community of bread trucks and of showers made out of cement block and laundromats and there are some little original outhouses that are turned into bakeries and soy dairies and things like that. And that part comes from a different place that I had studied and visited called The Farm, which was this intentional community from the late 60s to the early 80s in its heyday, and it still is going on today in Tennessee. And so it's really a mind meld of a couple of different ideas about a perfect place. And when I sat down to sort of write through for myself an essay of what I would plan as my ideal place, it ended up being this vision of Oneida and the farm and utopia.
What were some of the rules of this utopian world that you drew up in your own vision, if you were to design a utopia, or what were some of the principles that you wrote out in this essay you just mentioned?
Right. So some of the things were, and a lot of it is just cribbed from what other people have done, just because I'm not a philosopher, and I like to think things through, but I'm sort of a little bit of a magpie. And so I grabbed some ideas like just communalism, just the mere fact that people would live together. I think that that's a very important way to educate children. And because I have children, I do long for people to be always available to take care of them, because I want to be able to work also. And then, there's communal food making, and food making from as localized an environment as possible, because I think that that's a very important political thing that's going on today. I mean, we don't get most of our food from where we live, and I think trying to make most of our food from where we live is actually very important. So that's another aspect. No money. I mean, there's no barter system or anything. There's a gift system set in place as opposed to, a trading for goods system. And everyone works. And I actually really do like something that I first stole from Oneida, which is this idea of mutual criticism, where if someone is sort of not adhering to the philosophies of utopia, then everyone sits down and they talk about it, and they talk about these people's flaws. And of course, that can get very, very wrong very fast. But I like the idea of it. And honestly, I mean, I like the idea of a lot of things that I put into the Arcadia in the book. And I knew as I was writing them that in real life they possibly would not work out the way that you would hope they would, in the idealized place that you imagine.
Well, we were talking about the rules that you had, and the principles is a better, nicer word, that you had admired from many of these intentional communities that you visited. And in thinking through these kinds of communities for yourself, were there any principles or rules that you found would be necessary for an orderly society, but not really ideal? You would object to them on an idealistic principle, but because you know, things have to get done because of the practical nature of living together, they felt necessary.
Well, I don't, you know, there were some things that I think that could still work if people were very thoughtful about implementing them. But the problem is, with communities, it's very, very difficult to make decisions a lot of times, especially when some of the decision-making is sometimes influenced by anarchists, for instance. You know what I mean? Like, so it's very tricky to implement philosophy in real life because human beings are so extraordinarily complicated and messy. And when we present our ideals, sometimes we don't consider every aspect of how a person's going to react. And, you know, I think people, especially people who gravitate toward intentional communities, want very badly to do right and to do good things. But then there are aspects, for instance, of, so take communal child rearing, where it gets a little sticky because if one of your child rearers has her own child, how do you not put that child ahead of the needs of others? And, you know, how do you not show preference in a community like this when their personalities get along better or worse? So, I mean, there are a lot of things. I think in general, I would say that the general ideas are meaningful, and it just takes a lot of energy to keep them on track, and it takes a very small amount of personal discord to send the whole train off track.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly see in Arcadia the pursuit of these ideals and how fervently people are pursuing them. And the narrator of the novel is Bit, who is the first child born in Arcadia. And I'm hoping that you will read a couple of short passages. I was thinking one in which Bit's perceptions of Arcadia are of the beauty of the place and of the joy and the idealism of the successful moments of Arcadia, and then for contrast, maybe a short moment or a couple of sentences in which Bit sees some of the darkness or potential darkness of Arcadia.
Sure. I was actually just thinking when Bit goes for a run.
Oh yeah.
So that was a happy moment.
Yeah.
And it's on page 95.
And this is a moment in which Bit is going for a run and experiencing a joyous moment.
4 hours, Bit waits for sleep. Shortly before dawn, he gets up. When he rises, he listens for his friend's breath to stir. They sleep on. He opens the window to air out the room, the awful dead creatures that are Ike's feet, mixed adolescent voice stink. He carefully dresses in his shirt and jeans. His broken sneakers mouth open when he walks, toes lapping the air like tongues. Through the Addo unit common room, through the hallways, plaster gapping and lath exposed, down the smooth, polished banister for silence. Through the library heaped with whole earth catalogs, old New Yorkers, silverfish books dug up from the basement where the first inhabitants had stashed them, American eclectic, Walden, news from nowhere. Also, Carlos Castaneda, Julia Kristeva, Herman Wauk, paperback scavenged from dumpsters, or bought for a nickel. He slips through the eatery redolent of last night's enchiladas. It is early for the breakfast shift, who will soon clang pans and stir yeast and soy into scrambled yig and wash the apples wormy but good. All is still and nobody is awake but Bit. Out in the black, he runs down the slate steps by touch alone. The encampments across Arcadia are dark, only a few bobbing lights from afar, the flashlights of people rising for the loo. From the bakery, a rich bread smell rises. His skin prickles with cold, dew flings from his heels to his back. There's a sharp-edged the sky, pine tanging the air, stones scattering like live creatures under his step. He runs as fast as his legs can take him, very fast for a body small as his, then slows to enjoy the darkness softening in the woods. A cardinal flushes from a bush, but he has forgotten his new camera that his grandmother had sent him. He thinks of returning, but the run back is so far, and daybreak won't wait for him. One breath before dawn, he climbs the hill. At the top, in a cluster of sweet William above the pines, he sits to watch day begin to hatch its yellow. A hawk stretches its wings and swirls as it rises. The fog rolls from the ground like a blanket and swiftly covers the distant mountains, the field, the pond, the streams. Covers Amos the Amish's far-off barn, the thin lace that is Verta's smoke. A hungry creature, the fog, it gobbles. It climbs up the terraces with the crooked apple trees. At last, only Bits and Arcadia House sit, turned toward each other, each alone on a hill, above the fog's milky sea. Two islands they are, brightening in the dawn.
Thank you. That it's a beautiful moment. And it's interesting that this moment is running away a little, not running away, but taking a moment for himself away from Arcadia and looking back at it and still appreciating it. Is that how the moment feels to you?
It does, you know, I mean, I love humanity. Individual people, and this is part of the reason why I chose the profession, I can take people in very small quantities. So for me, the whole feeling of Arcadia is simply that, especially at this point in Bit's life there, it's just a feeling of just overwhelming peopleness, like too much humanity. And all I wanted was for him to get some time alone just to breathe and to think and to still, you know, love where he comes from. But, man, just to be alone.
Totally. It struck me as claustrophobic as well in some wonderful ways in certain moments, but that moment feels necessary for Bit in the way that moments of solitude are necessary for writers.
Right. And he ends up being an artist. I mean, he always has that observer's quality. But because he was raised in a communal environment, it's both very difficult for him to find solitude and very, very necessary. I mean, it's part of how he feeds himself and his soul.
Do you think that Bit's parents, Hannah and Abe, feel the same necessity for solitude that Bit does, or that the founders of Arcadia have a different idea of privacy or some different threshold?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's just one of those things for Hannah and Abe that actually wears them down over time. And it's just, you know, the invisible daily grind of the reality of living with a lot of people, it does become difficult. Even if one is like Hannah and Abe, if one is a people person, you know, very much an extrovert, it still becomes a kind of a weight on your shoulders. And I think, not to let anything out because this happens halfway through the book, but when Arcadia does implode a little bit, that's one of the things that you sense, or I would hope that one senses, as they are fleeing, there's a sense of just incredible freedom and looseness, at the same time as a lot of sorrow. But, I think they did. I mean, I think Hannah and Abe longed, after the many, many years that they were living there, they longed for sort of space of their own. And then when they got it, they didn't quite know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just the way that we deal with things. I mean, even if I was just at a writer's colony, which I loved, but I honestly did not know what to do with myself when I woke up in the morning and there weren't children, you know, putting their hands all over my face. And, you know, you just become accustomed to the life that you're living. And even if you believe that you want something else, it does it's quite a shock to not live there.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the choices that Hannah and Abe make when they're away from community, from Arcadia, are, I think, surprising to them because they haven't made choices in isolation for a long time.
Right, exactly. And it's difficult to come back to the world at large, which is by far a less caring and open place. You know, they come to the city, and it's...
to New York City.
You know, there are things in place for Abe, you know, to help him, but nobody is actually looking out for them. They sort of have to look out for themselves, and they haven't been used to that in a very long time, and it's saddening. In a way, to feel as if that you're kind of on your own, mm-hmm. as we are out here.
Right. That you mentioned when Arcadia begins to fall apart, and that one of the moments of that continues to haunt me from the book is towards the end there, when there are so many people coming into Arcadia, and especially the young women feel very much at risk to me, and I'm frightened for them, and Bit is frightened for them because of so many drug-addled men walking around Arcadia, and the ways that people are thinking about love and sex and relationships in Arcadia in general, and then at this time when things are quite scattered. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that decline period of Arcadia, and then maybe read from one of those sections where Bit is watching either Hel or one of female friends sort of walk around these dark tents at night in one of those haunting moments.
Sure. So here's the flip side of allowing yourself to be vulnerable, which I actually think is something that we should all work on a little bit better. I'm not very good at allowing myself to be vulnerable, but the people in Arcadia, so one of the things that I admire most about them is they do let themselves be vulnerable because they have a lot of trust in the people around them. But what happens when you allow strangers in is that you don't know, you know, this principle of trust gets a little shaken because you don't know who these people are. And at one point, there are so many strangers there that this vulnerability becomes not an asset of Arcadia, becomes a huge liability, because it's true. Young women and children and all of the weak, the pregnant ladies, the trippies, who are the people who have taken too much acid and they're taking care of, all of these people are a little bit at risk in this place that's supposed to be very safe for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Arcadia is under a lot of strain because one of the principles is that you take care of people who need you to take care of them. And if there aren't enough people taking care of the vulnerable, then they're at risk, and there's also not enough being done for the others who aren't at risk. So it's just this incredible balance that, you know, that needs to be sustained and is not at the end. And I'm glad to read a part. And I should probably set this up by saying that this day is this huge festival that was supposed to be just for the denizens of Arcadia, but somehow the word got out and tons of people came to crash this party, and it's putting a lot of strain on Arcadia. And this is in the middle of the night, and in Arcadia they have these beautiful apple trees, and they make something called Slap Apple, which is sort of an alcoholic drink. And someone put something really bad in the Slap Apple and Bit drank some of it. So this is way dark in the middle of the night, and he's wandering around in the forest. A new sound arises out of the forest, a low groan that, at first, he thinks is the music of the spheres, the great cold stars singing, not at all as lovely as he'd imagined. But it is too close, and Bit freezes, waits to see where the sound is coming from. There, he sees a pool of darkness, an oil slick that grows upward, becomes a black lump on the ground, lit in some places by the unshedded moon. Even if in his off-kilter brain he knows it is a couple of people having fun. Something isn't quite right, though, with the way the bodies are. It squints through the pulsing fog in his eyes. There is a person on top of another, yet the head of the second is in the wrong place, yards away, as if the body is both enormous and bent. A quickening, a rattle in the chest, a raw, bare growl, and then a belt buckle tingles, the fucker stands over the fuckie's legs. "Thanks, baby," comes a man's voice quietly. "You are amazing." A voice rises at girls. "Sure," she says. "It was fun." Now the man says, "Hey, you think you have a little sugar for my buddy here? What do you think? Share a little?" It's not as totally cool, but he really digs you. "Do you a favor for me." "You're just a gorgeous thing," says another voice, higher pitched, male. "Prettiest thing I've seen in a long, long time." There's a long pause, and the girl says, hesitant, "I don't..." "Come on," says the first man. "It's no big deal." He kneels and begins to whisper, and at last the girl's voice emerges from the darkness. "Okay," she says with bravado. The second man rises, belt jingles, crouches down, merges with the girl's body on the ground. But he can't move. He can't breathe. The man finishes and both men stand up, looking at the lump on the ground, struggling to sit. "Let's take her back," one says, and they pick the girl up between them and dust her off. One of them, it seems, picks something tenderly out of her hair. Bitch shrinks behind the tree beside him as they crash past over the sticks and leaves. They come straight at him, so close he can smell the musk of sex, closed cigarettes, blood, alcohol. Even closer, and he wills himself into the tree. They pass, and Bitch sees a sprinkle of black under one man's eye, the shimmer off a leather jacket, and Hella's face gleaming like its own moon, a comet tail of white in the air where she's been.
Thank you. That was exactly the moment I was thinking of, and I find it incredibly haunting because it's a very complicated moment. There is some tenderness in this moment also, but it's also, this moment becomes sort of crucial in the relationship between Bit and Hella, even though I don't know that it's specifically referred to later on in the book. Their relationship as it proceeds through the book is embodied here.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, if you come into a situation like this and he hasn't seen what's happened before, he just doesn't know what to do. And I'm not sure I would know what to do if you come across a situation like this, right? Because it feels very much like a violation.
Yes.
But the words said are not. And Hella is a different person, and she was raised differently. So it's all very fraught for Bit, and he can't quite understand it. And he knows something's wrong, but he doesn't know what or how to fix it.
Well, like you said, it's this community of innocents who are suddenly exposed to the world and have to figure out how to interact with people they have not known their whole lives. And they don't know.
Right. And you know what's funny? I mean, this is not funny. I mean, it's terribly sad. But when I was doing a lot of the precursor research to this book, all of the reading I was doing, I did notice a trend that sex is really the thing that blasts these places sometimes to pieces. I mean, Oneida, coming back to Oneida, the thing that really brought it down was the fact that they had just very strange sexual practices for the mid-19th century and the late 19th century. I mean, all the old men and women inducted the young people into the communal marriage that they had, for instance. And then even with, you know, more modern places, I mean, there have been a lot of sex scandals about these things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sex is just such a complicating feature, and I wanted badly to put it in because God, it's not simple for anyone or for anything, but especially in a community.
Mm-hmm. Right, there are rules in the beginning that are set up that then have to be changed and altered, or characters are then fighting over and disagreeing with, and watching Bit grow up in this community where Handy, the leader of the community, has multiple wives, and watching him figure out and try to on his own what this means and what his own relationships with friends and women are going to be like. It's very interesting.
Yeah, right, exactly. And Handy's an interesting creature just because, you know, he gets away with things that are just kind of not really agreed on anymore. And he doesn't necessarily change as the community does. And there's a part of him that's very much ruled by ego in a place that's supposed to be fairly egoless.
Mm-hmm.
So when Bit looks at Handy, he sees someone he actually truly admires, part of his coming, sort of the building moment part of this book is how Bit tries to understand what he agrees with and what he doesn't, and then what he can understand from Handy and the example of Handy and his father Abe, who, you know, they are in a lot of ways opposing voices in Arcadia.
Mm-hmm. No, they're in a way they're supposed to be equal, but Handy is also the leader or the figurehead,
right.
and perhaps more charismatic.
Even though he calls himself the teacher, he is the leader.
Even though he calls himself the
teacher,
yes,
the guru. He's, a guru is still a leader, in a leaderless place, and so there's just this inherent tension there that is almost impossible to get over, I think.
Yeah, listening to them argue and watching Handy still want and need to be the leader at a time when the community is thinking about a change in leadership structure is applicable to so many societies. I want to talk a little bit about the parenting and parents and children in this book, because I think that Arcadia contains some of the most exquisite descriptions and painful reflections on parenting that that I've ever read. And in a profile in the New York Observer, you had said that Arcadia became a long, painful argument with myself about what you need to do in order to be happy with bringing children into the world. So I'm wondering if one thing you could talk about a little bit is how you wrote about parenting in this book that was different from how you thought about writing about parenting before you had kids, and The Monsters of Templeton, for example. Are there different ways that you think about, certainly your life is different, but different ways that you think about portraying parenting and those parent-child relationships in your writing?
Well, you know, so I'm incredibly fraught about, you know, everything for me, every decision is incredibly fraught. But it is true that, this book really is a long argument. And the problem with this argument is that it's never won. And I can come to sort of a place of stasis for a little while, and then something sparks it up again. And so even though the book is over, the argument continues in me and in the world, and me versus the world, I guess. But, you know, in my previous books, I hadn't been a parent. I think I probably related to the idea of parentage as a daughter, because that's all I'd been at any given time, and sort of a daughter of a town and a daughter of people, and that the idea of legitimacy was really big also, because in the beginning of a career you do wonder about your legitimacy in every way, right? In whether or not you are the person who can tell this story, whether or not you are legitimately a writer in the eyes of the world, which you're not, if you until you actually have your name on an article or something and you're published, there's just a strong question about legitimacy. So The Monsters of Templeton is really about that idea of parentage. And then what
about
being, was,
but more about being a daughter and sort of being raised in the question of...
and where you belong, and sort of the long line of your ancestors, but also, in my case, because I'm a writer, literary antecedents. I mean, where do you fit in, I guess, was my previous concern. And then I was pregnant with my first son, Beckett, who's almost four now. And I was waiting for The Monsters of Templeton to come out, and I was deeply depressed. And it was just tremendously bad. And, you know, when I work, I'm less depressed. And that's possibly another reason why I do write. And so, I had to sit down with myself and figure out what was making me so anxious and what was making me, like, look up millenarianism. And I had also read Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which is the worst thing to read when you're pregnant.
Right.
And, you know, like, there are very legitimate fears about where we are going as a society that I indulged to the max. Insofar, and, you know, I live in Florida, which is Hurricane Alley, and so at every moment we're afraid of, you know, our house being blown over. So there's just a lot of fear and anxiety, and it just was exacerbated at that time. And so I had to look for something in my work that would put it into perspective or reframe the argument or just get me involved enough to forget myself. And the only thing that I hit on was the idea of happy people, and which translated into the idea of idealistic people, people who actually are very cognizant of the threats of the world and yet try to do their own thing and try to make something beautiful, sort of almost in the face of anxiety. So I guess, you know, this book was born of a huge amount of anxiety, and it was a way to control that fucking anxiety and to let me get through my pregnancy. What was really amazing was, you know, it's not like I had really much of a choice by a certain time in the pregnancy. You know, like, he was coming. But as soon as the baby was here, I feared less because there was truly nothing that could happen. You know, like everything could happen outside the world, but now I just had to deal with it. Does that make any sense?
So you mean once the baby arrived, you were faced with the sort of practical concerns of caring for it, rather than any anxieties about whether what you were doing was the right thing.
Right, exactly. So the ethical decision in having a child is no longer really in play because he was here. You know, like I couldn't fight on this sort of this plane, and I had to fight on a more practical plane. So it was amazing, because as soon as he was born, this anxiety lifted off of me like a cloak and went somewhere else, and kind of enabled the book to be written entirely. So before, I did a lot of research, and then I just wrote the book. This is a deeply personal book. It's definitely not autobiographical, but the idea, and it's personal also in the way that my parents are getting older. You know, in this book, there's a lot of discussion about how do we face down our, you know, eventual demise. I mean, we are all human, which means we will all die. And how do you face that prospect with grace and dignity? And how do you face the prospect of people close to you not being here anymore? I mean, it's very... that could fulfill you with anxiety also. So, I mean, there's so much of a fight that I continue to have in this book. And I haven't answered any questions, unfortunately, but I don't think that's what novels are for. I sort of feel like they're just about asking the questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, and your deep probing of the, of these questions is what is, this is the forum for you to work those things out. And the, I mean, the book is as much as it's about parenting and giving birth, we see so many cycles in the book and cycles of loss. I mean, Arcadia as an ideal and as a place are lost. There's the facing of losing loved ones, losing physical abilities. And thinking about all of this loss, and in particular the characters' reactions to what they lose, I'm interested in how you thought about writing about grief and the different incarnations of grief for different kinds of people. Grief, I think, can be challenging to portray sometimes because it's such a profoundly universal emotion. It can be hard to make it distinct to a character or to show how different kinds of loss feel differently to a person. Can you say anything about how you thought about these different characters' reactions to different kinds of loss? Or their different mourning and grieving processes?
The bad thing about writing about grief is that, as you said, it's so universal, but that's also the good thing about it. I mean, practically everyone on the planet knows loss or will know loss in some form or another. And it's what makes us able to empathize and to really feel for other people. And what is reading a book but the ultimate act of empathy? So in this book, from the beginning, I knew that it was going to be about losing, losing Arcadia and facing the prospect of losing, because we all do lose. And going back to what we were saying before, you know, having this argument with myself, I guess the thing that was paralyzing me was the fear of losing. It's a reality. We're going to have to do this. I'm going to have to do this. We are all going to have to handle it. And the fear is not productive, really. The anxiety is it's the ugly underbelly of it. So being able to write about projected loss was being able to look at it firmly in the face and understand that it will happen in a sort of a controlled environment. I guess it's the same impulse that made me write about a more idealized community. It's my way to create a plastic model that can change under the pressure of the characters and to see how things happen. And I think the novelistic urge is to do this thing, to create a hypothesis, set characters loose, and see what happens.
That's how you learn.
That's how we do it. And the plastic hypothesis, some of the many in this book are, how do you make an ideal community? How do you deal with grief? How do you deal with losing what we will all lose? And even though this is an intensely, so what had happened was most my books are written from an intensely personal place. And if I'm lucky, I try after the first 5 or 6 drafts to try to see if they can become maybe a little bit more universal. So it's not just private and specific. It becomes maybe a little bit more universal. But it's always the big struggle, right, in writing anything. As you know, because you're a writer, you create this thing that is so meaningful to you, and you have to try to make it meaningful to other people. Mm-hmm. So this is just a big, long exploration of everything that I was afraid of. All the boogeymans underneath the bed. If you're there, world.
Call them out one by one.
Right, exactly.
Well, I have just one last question for you, which is about reading. And we've compared a few notes about authors who we love and tremendously admire, including Alice Munro and Shirley Hazard and Marilyn Robinson. So one small question is just, were there any literary guides or models that you were thinking about when you were when you were writing Arcadia. I know you read widely and voraciously, perhaps more than anyone I know. So you're probably reading much during those years that you were writing the book, but were there any voices or particular works that you returned to because they helped you move forward in writing Arcadia or reminded you of something that you wanted to do with Arcadia?
Absolutely. And, you know, and there were books that I looked at for the philosophy and for the ideas, and there are books that I look at for just the mere fact that I want to spend life, so part of my life, in the presence of these authors. And some of the people that you mentioned actually are people whose books sit right now on my desk. I read Marilyn Robbins' Housekeeping. And there are parts of Housekeeping actually in Arcadia, the place in the first few drafts, the place where Bit is born is actually Fingerbone from, is it Fingerbone? I think it's
Fingerbone. Yeah, Fingerbone. Yeah, that's...
But Middlemarch is a book that is really the foundational text of Arcadia. I love George Eliot. I love her wisdom, and I love her empathy, and I love everything she stands for, which is, I sort of see her as the far end of the spectrum of literary empathy, and on the other end is Ayn Rand. Here is, like, the absence of literary empathy. There's John Milton in Paradise Lost, which is obviously a precursor, just, I saw this book as being, you know, Paradise Lost and somewhat regained in the way that we regain it in our lives. And when I want a sentence, or when I just feel at loss for words themselves, I always look at Mavis Gallant. Mm. Shirley Hazard's The Transit of Venus is another book that I always have on my desk, no matter what. There are so many people I just am in love with, and am passionately in love with, and if I ever meet them, you know, I'm actually hoping that I never ever get to meet them, because I don't know if I would be able to handle the gap between who I think they are and who they actually are.
Worship is a hard thing to carry around and then to present to to the idol.
Oh my God. But you know this, right? Because there are people, I'm sure, some of the people you talk about, I mean, we have very overlapping Venn diagrams of who we adore, Jen, you and I.
Yeah, all of those people.
All of those people. They're all amazing. Deborah Eisenberg, oh my God, that lady. She's so fantastic. So they're just, you know, they're people, and most of them for me are short story writers who are just deeply empathetic, and I think that's what I look for when I look for writing.
Yeah, all of those authors have a kind of a kind of warmth to the prose. I think Hazard might be the most analytical of them, or maybe Eisenberg and sort of the coolest in temperament. But they still bring such rich understanding to the characters that yeah, that's why you read them.
I actually think Deborah Eisenberg is not at all cool. I think I think of her as she has a pretense to coolness that underlies this like frantic warmth.
Mm.
But Shirley Hazard, I mean, I don't know. I don't find her at all cool. I find her hot. Yeah, you know, like she just burns really bright to me.
Oh, I think I think the emotions are really fierce.
Yeah. But no, I mean, there's so many, and it's funny that I feel like I've pretty much only mentioned women. That's not at all the case, but the people who are alive that I think of as models tend to be female writers. I just realized that. That's amazing.
Yeah, I realized that recently too, just in composing this. Actually, just in comparing notes with you about my top five, you know, people novelists who I recommend and whose books I pass around.
James Salter is a man. He's fantastic.
Who did you say? I missed you. Oh, James Salter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Love the James Salter.
Yes, that too. Him too. he can climb up into the Pantheon.
Yes, he can. Even if he's a man.
That's right. Well, it was really fun to talk to you. More than fun. Enlightening.
Me too.
And wonderful. So I'm going to say, Lauren, such a pleasure again, as always, and congratulations on Arcadia. I look forward to the next book and to our next conversation.
Me too, Jen. Thank you so much.